Yeah, okay. So I don't know how many of you were here at the conference last week. Most of you, I guess, were not here. Is that right? For those of you who were here, about 30% of what I'm going to say, I already said. But I said it very fast, and I'm going to tell you all the things I didn't say then, and also the things I did say, I had to do it very quickly. And so I'm going to dwell a bit on those of the same things I said last time. So I hope you will not be resentful to hear the same kind of things twice in this space of only 10 days. So what I'm going to tell you about is something that gradually has dawned upon me, that there is a way to rule out particle physics candidates for the dark matter that is clean, neat, and conclusive. So I should say I have had the good luck of being involved with CDM from the very beginning, which was here. So the CDM was born in this place, not in this building. This building hadn't been built. There was a program in 1984 where many of the first papers on CDM were written. And I was saying to Lucho that I still remember a bit of a grassy little patch by a restaurant over there where the word biased galaxy formation was invented by Mark Davies. Anyway, so, but it was clear already from the beginning of CDM that the whole goal, the whole purpose, at least from my point of view, was to rule it out because that's just the way we advance in science. But I spent 30 years of my life trying to rule this thing out, doing it the wrong way. And that is because we thought, well, we rule this out, or test it if you wish, by comparing with data, of course. And the only data we have, or we have had most of the data, not the only data, but most of the data comes from looking at objects in the universe, galaxies. And so one of the big lessons of all these 30 years has been to understand that galaxy formation is complicated and adds a layer of insoluble complexity to the goal of testing the theory, because galaxy formation is just complicated. So in the old days, we just thought, well, surely galaxies must trace the dark matter, and maybe with a little bit of bias. And in fact, it turns out that it is much too complicated. So although there have been, of course, important tests of the CDM theory with the microwave background, for example, and to some extent with galaxy clustering, these tests, apart from the microwave background, are not really conclusive. But even the microwave background doesn't really test the essence of cold dark matter. So what I'm going to tell you about now is how you actually can go to the key prediction of CDM that's unencumbered by galaxy formation, and how, in principle, the theory could be ruled out. So that's the goal, either to rule out CDM or interesting alternatives. So let me tell you what I mean by interesting alternatives. Here's the power spectrum of density perturbations coming out of inflation. So this is the power spectrum. These are large scales. These are small scales, power spectrum of density perturbation. Inflation predicts it's almost scale-invariant power law power spectrum. But then in the early phases of the universe, some of these fluctuations don't grow as fast. That's why this is not a power law. There's some damping processes that occur in the early universe when the universe is dominated by radiation. But then the nature of the power spectrum depends on the properties of the particles. And so if the dark matter is a hot particle, like, for example, a neutrino with a mass of a few tens of electron volts, then those particles are relativistic at early times, so they free stream out of fluctuations, and the power spectrum acquires a cutoff, as shown here, on scales of galaxy clusters. So in the case of hot dark matter, the sequence of cosmogony would be very different from what we're used to. Galaxy clusters would form first, and then galaxies would have to form later by some sort of fragmentation. In the case of cold dark matter, there is a cutoff, but it's very, very, very small mass at masses possibly of the size of the Earth. And so there's a completely big difference here in what different models for particles, dark matter, predict. Now, so in those days, in the 80s, we knew about hot dark matter. In fact, we thought that was going to be the answer. We knew about cold dark matter because there were already supersymmetric particles had been already talked about in the case of Hope Dagmar, it was very exciting because there was a report that had filtered through the Iron Curtain in the late 70s or early 80s that some Russians or Soviets, as they were then, had measured a neutrino mass, Lubimov and Novikov, a neutrino mass of 30 electron volts, which would be exactly what was needed to provide the Dagmar. It turned out that was not the answer and that experiment was wrong. So then that's then where the whole thing started. And then 30 years later, this is where we are. So, yeah?
How did you define the boundaries between Hope and...
It was just arbitrary. I can even tell you where the nomenclature was invented. Dick Bohm invented it, not here, in Aspen. Yeah, in Aspen, when I was being very dumb that day. We were having breakfast, and he was trying to explain to me the difference between relativistic and non-relativistic particles. And he said, look, relativistic particles free stream. Non-relativistic particles don't, when they decouple. So think about it like this. Some are hot, some are cold. And then his face lit up and said, oh, yeah. Hot Dagmar, cold Dagmar. That sounds cool. That's how it was invented. There's no boundary between them. It's just an arbitrary. Dick Bond?
Dick Bond.
He denies it, but you know, he's growing old.
Old.
Oh yeah. The nomenclature hot, cold, and warm. I don't know about warm. It was invented by Dick.
Claims, like priority.
Yes.
Who says that, yes, it was my invention.
Well, because I persuaded him. Sure. For the first time I said to him, Dick, you remember in Aspen, we were sharing a house, and you told me about this. He said, oh, I didn't do that. And I said, Dick, I remember, your memory is failing. Anyway, all right, so Laura, so there's no clear cut difference. The main thing is that the cutoff here depends inversely, roughly, on the mass of the particle. So if the mass is very light, 30 electron volts, then you get a very large cutoff. In the case of galaxy clusters, I'm going to tell you quite a bit about warm dark matter today. And there, the cutoff is on a smaller mass, dwarf galaxies, because the mass is smaller. So for a mass of a few keV, I'm going to talk about that, then the cutoff is on the scale of dwarf galaxies. All right. So here's 30 years later. Here's what we've learned. So. There are lots of people worked on this and made careers, and this is it. This is about all we've learned in cosmology, line. Neil, I'm exaggerating. I'm just being a little bit colorful, but it's a summary of where we are today in an understanding of this narrow question of what is the universe made of and how did structure come to be. That small, narrow question, here is a summary. And what you have here is the power spectrum. Now compared the theory in black with measurements in color. So these are measurements from the microwave background, temperature and isotropies extrapolated to redshift zero using linear theory, which you can compare with galaxy clustering. All right, so this looks really good. The theory preceded the observations, particularly the microwave background, is a genuine prediction. We don't often come across this in astrophysics, that you predict something important, and then it gets verified empirically years later. So, but here it is, the prediction, and then the observations. So, I don't want to offend Neil again, but this to me summarizes 30 years of work by quite a lot of people. It's been other things done, I know, but this is how the program started, and this is where we are. Now, so if you're a pessimist, like I am not, you say, great, great achievement, but this tells us nothing about lambda, no idea what lambda is from this match. And sadly, it doesn't tell us anything about CDM either. It doesn't tell us the dark matter is called dark matter. For example, if the dark matter was a warm particle, say a stellar neutrino, I'm going to talk about them in a minute, then what would happen here is that there would be a cutoff on scales that are not probed by any of these data, because the data on galaxy clustering that are a bit out of date with Sloan, but it looks just the same, petered out on scales of a few tens of megaparsecs. I mean, the agreement is important, right? It's impressive. There's several orders of magnitude here, 2.5 orders of magnitude in scale, about 8 orders of magnitude in mass. So it's not a negligible achievement to be here, but warm dark matter would only differ from CDM on scales that are not probed by any of these data. And so if the dark matter was not an axion or a supersymmetric particle or a WIMP, but a stellar neutrino, for example, I'm going to tell you about them in a minute, would be none the wiser. All the success of CDM would transfer directly to that case. Now, So let me tell you a bit about stellar neutrinos. These are quite interesting particles. I like them particularly because just like CDM, the axion or a WIMP have a motivation independently of large-scale structure, so do the WIMP, so do the stellar neutrinos. And so there is a particular model of, so the stellar neutrinos are particles beyond the standard model. They are almost kind of related to right-handed neutrinos in the standard model. And they provide an explanation for a number of puzzles of the standard model. For example, in the standard model, neutrinos should have mass and they should oscillate. Stellar neutrinos provide an explanation for that. They also provide an explanation for baryogenesis, why is there more matter than antimatter in the universe? And they provide an explanation for dark matter. There is a particular, there are many ways to do this. One that I find quite interesting is something called the stellar neutrino minimal standard model, proposed by Boyarsky, Shaposhnikov, and their colleagues. And there, in this case, there are three stellar neutrinos. Two are very massive and, in principle, are detectable in the LHC. They are the ones that do all the good things. And then the other one is the KEB stellar neutrino that, Alex, you don't like, Misham. What? Something you didn't like? All right, good.
Well, I was pointing out that the names and the dates were wrong, but that's.
Oh, sorry. No. Which day? No. Well, this Asaka, whatever his name is, but there's Boyarsky as well. The two papers, the same year. The other one was 08. Which one did I get wrong?
No, I think there was an earlier paper by
Misha. Yeah, Misha started working on this.
No, but the person who gave his name was Alex. Anyway, so. Doesn't matter. They're the same crew. Anyway, so and then the dark matter is kind of put in by hand with the KEB stellar neutrino. So the mass of that one is essentially chosen to give you the dark matter.
How high can the mass be in KEB, the lightest
here? How
high?
Or it could be anything. It could
I don't know, 50 KEB.
Oh, sure. It could be. So in fact, yes, it could be anything. Now, let me come back to this plot in a minute. Let me show you this one first. So the mass could be anything in KEV. It's put in to be interesting, to be different from CDM, but it could be 50 KEV and then look just like CDM. But the thing is, both, as I said, CDM and warm dark matter are compatible with the CMB and galaxy clustering, and there are, as many of you would know, already claims that both kinds of dark matter have been discovered. CDM through the famous gamma ray excess in the galactic center, heard a lot about that last week, and warm dark matter through the decay line seen in stacks of galaxy clusters and in galaxies at 3.53 keV, which would then indicate a stellar neutrino of twice that mass of 7 keV. So there are claims that both types of dark matter have been discovered. I mean, it's been claims that are fairly old now, completely controversial. I think it's very unlikely that both of them are correct. I think most people would say it's very unlikely that either of them is correct. But the claims are there, and they're not refuted yet. And so that is, I think we should take both of these candidates seriously. Well, firstly, because they're well-motivated, at least reasonably well-motivated, and secondly, because there are at least possible detections of them. Now, one more thing about stellar neutrinos. So, the stellar neutrino, like Laura says, has a free parameter, which is the mass that determines the cutoff. But it has another free parameter, which determines the amount of baryogenesis that goes on. So unlike CDM, where there are no free parameters, there are zero free parameters, and the amplitude of the spectrum is fixed by the microwave background, here, in principle, you have two parameters. And two-dimensional space is very, very big. However, if one takes seriously the 3.5 keV line, then that allows you to make some progress because then you fix the mass and there's only one free parameter, which is this thing called L6, which is that one, which has to do with the baryon asymmetry. And so depending on, so for a fixed mass, depending on the value of L6, you get different power spectra. And if you're like me, who's trying to make predictions from this.
That's why it's called L.
Well, okay, but they're related. Yes, true.
No, actually, this parameter is unrelated to baryon asymmetry, right? Because baryon asymmetry is 10 to the minus 10, and if this parameter was related to it, it would be way too small to affect stellar neutrino production.
It's 10 to the minus 10.
So this is an additional leptin asymmetry that you need in order to create the resonance in the neutron oscillations and produce them on resonance.
But this has to do with the baryon asymmetry as well.
It's to do with
baryogenesis.
This is the lepton asymmetry.
Sure, but it has to do because the baryogenesis follows from
the
stellar neutrino.
The lepton asymmetry that is unrelated to baryogenesis. The lepton asymmetry that
L6
is related at the same time with baryon asymmetry is related by these phalerons, which again were pioneered by Bishop. And
yes.
They are of the same order of magnitude. Okay.
Right.
L6 is.
All right. So
the other parameters.
This I got this slide. I got from Alexei Boyarsky.
So
I need to go back to these guys.
That's right.
I'll beat him up.
Exactly.
In any case, L6 L for lepton.
Exactly.
Thanks for criticizing things.
So these Ukrainians,
caution because you have to use the nonlinear power spectrum.
That's what?
You have to use the nonlinear power spectrum here, where all the cutoffs are just not as dramatic, I think, as you're showing for the linear power spectrum.
This is the linear power spectrum.
Yeah, I know. I think you were.
So this is the linear power. Anyway, I'm trying to make a much more.
Cutoffs are not as dramatic.
In addition. So this assumes that production of sterile neutrinos occurs only through neutrino oscillations.
Yes.
Now, if you have some Higgs decays that contributed to sterile neutrino population earlier on, then the particles with the same mass will appear as a colder component of dark matter. So you can have all dark matter in sterile neutrinos of, say, 7 keV mass, but one component is factor 3 colder than the other in terms of the phase training length.
Sure. Well, these are the non-resonant, the resonantly produced component.
Right. There is non-resonant production.
But there is resonant and non-resonant here.
In addition,
yes.
You can have production that has nothing to do with the neutrino oscillations.
All right, fine.
And if that happens, at the temperatures above a GeV,
yes.
Then during the VCB transition, that component gets redshifted, and their momenta go down by factor 3. So then you have a subpopulation of the same particles, but with free streaming lengths that is factor 3 smaller.
All right.
Right.
Okay, that's fine. Fine. So it can be more complicated, but at least for this. But this is the minimal business.
This is not minimal, but it's somewhere in between.
Isn't this one the neutrino minimal standard model? Anyway, point is. That they say, I'm just trying to say something much simpler than that.
Well, okay, so
let me just carry on, Alex, because otherwise I'm going to finish. But point is that there's more complexity here because you can have different cutoffs depending on the value of L6 for this particular model. It could be even more complicated. I think you talked about that last week.
This is true for one model that Alexei likes and he gave you this slide.
Well, that's right. He didn't give you the slide, actually. Mark Lobo gave me the slide. This came from Alex. Anyway, point is that you say, well, then how are we ever going to rule this out? Now, so the interesting thing here is, at least with this model, the range of cutoffs in the power spectrum is actually bounded. So it doesn't increase monotonically with this lepton parameter, but it actually, the cutoff as the lepton asymmetry parameter goes down, then this goes there and then comes back. So point is, this is a very well-defined model. I mean, it has a freedom, which is this L6, but in principle, you can rule it out. So it makes definitive predictions. You can always make them more complicated, but that is an attraction of this model. Okay, so now then, let me now get to what I want to say. So how would you rule them out? Before I tell you how to rule them out, let me show you the difference that it makes from the point of view of structure formation. So here on the left is how a Milky Way halo, dark matter halo, would form in CDM. On the right, it's what you would expect in warm dark matter. So here, by some high redshift, 15 or so, you see that's already quite a lot of structure that's forming CDM. These are very, very small lumps. Nothing's happened in warm dark matter, well, in the stellar neutrino case, because there's a cutoff. So this is going to collapse into a galactic halo. So this would be a megaparsec or something. Yeah, one galactic halo. So this would be about a megaparsec or so. So nothing's happened yet in the warm dark matter model because the power spectrum has a cutoff. So there's no way to form structure. So structure begins to form, already is quite advanced in CDM, and nothing's yet happened in warm dark matter. Here, finally, by redshift 12 or so, lumps begin to appear in warm dark matter, and the phases of the simulations are the same. So this lump is that lump, this one's that one, that one's that one. And then at the end, the two are very different. So you see that in the case of CDM, the Milky Way halo should be full of small lumps, like you see here on the left. This movie was made by Mike Lovell. And here in the case of a stellar neutrino with 7 keV, you should see a lot less structure. So there are no observational astronomers here. Any observational astronomers? They should, oh, one, sorry. But you should be very embarrassed that you know, you spend billions of dollars with satellites and all sorts of things, and you can't tell us whether the Milky Way lives here or lives there. I mean, it should be, if I was an observational astronomer, I would be hiding under the table. But not for long, not for long. Because actually it's a good reason why observers can't tell whether we live here or there. And the reason is the following. We're looking here at a picture of the dark matter, and observers, of course, telescopes don't see dark matter, they see visible matter.
What's the thermal equivalent mass of
it? It's 3.3 keV. Right? So,
okay, so we can constrain it to 2.9 keV.
Yeah.
So, like.
Well, all right.
Qualitatively, right? Yeah, qualitatively.
You mean from the Lyman Alpha Forest?
No, from Dwarf Galaxy observations in the Milky Way.
Well, okay, I'm going to come to that. I am going to come to that, and I disagree with you. I completely disagree with you, and I'm going to show you a plot. All right, so how can we distinguish between it? So he's saying, well, go look at satellites. Go count the satellites, right? That's what he's saying. Here you expect hundreds of thousands. Here you expect, you know, 50 or so, right? Now, we know the Milky Way has 50 satellites measured. Game over. Right? So we live in a universe made of stellar neutrinos, because if you count here, there's 50 of them, and here there's hundreds of thousands, right? So we can all go and have some lunch. Right? We already know what the dark matter is. Well, that is profoundly incorrect, because, and that's the reason why, and it's the reason why the observers should not feel embarrassed. And the reason we've known for 20 years is that most of these things are dark. They never manage to make a galaxy because they're too small. And small things never make a galaxy for two reasons. One reason is that we know the gas is reionized very soon by the first generation of stars and possibly maybe by other things, but we know the gas, we observe it to be reionized, and reionized hydrogen is heated up to 10 to the 4 Kelvin, right? The effective temperature of most of these small halos is less than 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So the gas just has too much entropy, and it doesn't see these lumps. It cannot cool in them because it's too hot. It will never be able to cool into the vast majority of these small halos. Now, it will begin to cool in slightly bigger halos, and then they would make stars, which, because the potential wells are shallow, would blow out the gas. And so in addition to the fact that reionization kills off galaxy formation in most of these halos, the ones that just poke their head above the parapet, they get zapped by supernova feedback. So those two processes mean that it's complicated to know how many satellites you expect. So here's a simulation that is part of something called the Eagle Project. To simulate galaxy formation, it's called the Apostle Project, which is because it was apparently, I didn't invent that name, Till Savala, my postdoc at the time, invented it, because I think there was 11, not 11 of us, but 11 simulations. That's for the project of simulating the local environment. Anyway, here's the Milky Way, here's Andromeda, as you would see it if you had a dark matter telescope. It looked really sensational, but with an optical telescope, this is what you see. And so it's a huge difference between the world of dark matter and the world that you can see. And only the biggest ones of these make a galaxy. So that one, for example, and that one, they succeeded in making a galaxy. That one also, that one made a galaxy. But the vast majority are completely dark. And they're dark because, as I said, gas is reionized and you can never cool into this halo. So we've known them for a long time. And in fact, one of my students many years ago, Andrew Benson, who's now at Carnegie, he calculated the expected number of satellites taking into account this very simple physics. I mean, this was analytical, semi-analytical work, as we call it. It's trivial to compute these effects. And he found that this was the luminosity function of satellites known at the time. And he found that that's what you would expect due to this process that I just mentioned. And he, there's a lot of scatter here. These are number of satellites, function of luminosity, that's the bright end. There's a lot of scatter here. He made a prediction, which it was there already in 2002, that there should be a population of ultra-faint dwarfs, and that was discovered several years later. Now, it doesn't tell us that dark matter is CDM, but if it is CDM, we understand why there's so few satellites. And we can do that now with much fancier hydro simulations, but the answer is, of course, the same. It's very simple physics. So gas can only cool in the biggest of these halos, and the other ones will always be dark. And so here are some more modern simulations with hydro and everything you can imagine in them, with millions of hours of CPU time. But the answer is the same. And here you see, for example, for the Milky Way, there's many, many, many dark matter halos, and only very few managed to make a galaxy. The simulations are the black line, and the observations are the black line, simulations are the green line, and it's very good agreement, Milky Way, M31, and so on. So I think we understand why.
I think there's an important third point, though, on your list. I mean, it's true that reionization and supernova feedback do that. At redshift zero, like, up to half of these subhalos might not exist, right, if you believe the disruption in the hydro simulation. Right?
I'm going to come to that. Okay. I'm going to come to precisely that. Yeah. All right. So maybe taking too long.
Yeah. Another point. In our simulations, what we found when we compare warm dark matter and cold dark matter for dwarfs, we clearly see a difference in the star formation history. So, like as you said before, because they start forming later, the ones that become visible, I mean, the ones that are seen, they have systematically a later onset of star formation in warm dark matter, by even a few gigayears. But I don't know if you've seen the same effect.
Yes and no. So yes. In principle, yes, because structure forms much later, like we saw in the movie. But then what happens that I thought was really interesting is when, so CDM is very inefficient when it's making small structure because it's all this feedback keeps blowing gas out. And so it just toggles along at high redshift, whereas in warm dark matter, the first things that collapse are quite massive. And then they make a big splash, a big burst. And actually, we have some predictions, some of the papers, can't remember which one, I think Sarnak-Bose was the first author, where we find that the luminosity function of galaxies at redshift 10 is actually brighter in warm dark matter than in CDM, paradoxically and completely counterintuitively. But
there's another, I think, interesting fact that Peter Biermann and I studied, that if dark matter is warm dark matter in the form of stellar neutrinos, they give out some X-rays.
Yes.
These X-rays ionize the gas, and ionized gas forms molecular hydrogen faster. And once you have molecular hydrogen, it's a very good cooling agent. So even though you flag some small halos, once you introduce molecular hydrogen, the bigger halos collapse faster. So you expected a late star formation, but in fact you speed it up because you have this additional ionizing radiation that introduces more H2, right? And so for some masses of stellar neutrinos, you have enough X-rays to actually,
exactly. Yeah, but the gas are complicated, you know, because they're shielding effects, there's Werner Lyman radiation, there's all sorts of complexities, but yes, right. So, but anyway, I think as I'm going to show, those are not interesting to test this. So here is the plot that's interesting. So here, I hope the other ones are interesting too, but here's the key one. So what's plotted here? It's a function of mass of a halo. Just look at the right axis. This is the fraction of halos of a given mass that are dark. Okay, so here, 100% are dark with masses less than a few times 10 to the 8. They're all dark. They're all bright beyond 10 to the 10. And then there's a very sharp transition between them. Right? So the fraction of halos, of dark halos, that have never seen a baryon in their life, or very few baryons, it's 100% for a mass below about 5 times 10 to the 8, and then 100% of halos are lit up, or at least have baryons, at masses greater than 10 to the 10. So that's the key thing. And here's the world of baryons. It's complicated. There's supernovae, there are quasars, there are all sorts of things. And one lesson I've learned in 30 years of doing cosmology is that, interesting as the visible universe is, we're never going to learn about the nature of the dark matter by looking at things that shine. We have to go and look at the little ones that don't shine. Now, before that, yep.
All of those X's are wet.
These are from simulations, from the Apostle simulations that I show you, where we have all the galaxy formation and everything. So this slightly model dependent, these plots. For example, if you talk to people down the road in Caltech, Phil Hopkins and co, or up the road in whatever. No, they don't do this stuff. But anyway, so we argue about whether this 5 × 10⁸ or 2 × 10⁸. But I think nobody disputes the fact that below certain mass, all halos are dark, and above.
But I mean, I'm just wondering, the X's where they said stuff should shine up, shines. So why are their halos so low masses?
Say it again.
The X's that are supposed to be dark in the simulations.
So this is the fraction of halos that are dark. So here 100% are dark, all of them are dark until you get to about a few times 10 to the 8. Then there's a sharp transition. So here, that half, some of them are dark, some are light. Depends on the stochastic nature of galaxy formation. And above 10 to the 10, 100% of them have some variance in them.
That is 3.3. Instead of
one. No, sorry. This is.
But won't that matter, how would that look?
I'm about to show you. So, but this is.
This is for gold.
Well, this yes, this particular. So here you're assuming that halos of all masses. Yes, so it's for gold.
Yeah. In other words, there is a cutoff.
Oh, yeah. Sub-halos, right?
Yeah. Well, let me show you what happens with one. Yeah, I'm coming to NSX. So how about in warm dark matter? So. What happens in warm dark matter is that the cutoff in the power spectrum, remember, is inversely proportional to the mass of the particle. So let me just show you what happens for different particle masses. So this is not yet visible. This is just the number of dark halos that there are. And so depending, this is not for stellar neutrinos. This is just for the thermal warm dark matter relic. Then you see that your CDM. And here are various warm dark matter models where the particle mass changes from 1.4 keV all the way to 2.3 keV. And you see that because the cutoff depends inversely, as I said, on the mass of the particle, then if the mass of the particle is very light, the cutoff is very aggressive and you end up with no lumps that could make satellites. And by the time you get to 2 or 3 keV, then you begin to make a few lumps. Now, so. In the case of warm dark matter, here are for stellar neutrinos with a mass of 7 keV, which is the one that's supposed to have been measured. Then if you take that measurement seriously, which you may or may not want to, but at least means that I have to show one dimension of the problem, there you see that this is the number of satellites, again, as a function of stellar mass. And in the case of CDM, as I just showed you from Andrew Benson's and subsequent work, there's perfectly good agreement. But by the time you get to some of these warm dark matter stellar neutrino models, there are some that do not produce enough lumps even to account for all the satellites that you see. So you can rule those out. For instance, this one, there was this lepton parameter, L6, that I mentioned before. And for large values of that, then you end up with not producing enough satellites to account for the ones we see. So you can already rule out quite a lot of parameter space of stellar neutrinos just from the fact that if the cutoff is too aggressive, then you just obliterate the Milky Way and there's no satellites, not enough to be seen. So, yep.
Can you compensate that by changing the galaxy formation model?
Well, so you can set a very strong limit. If we knew as we now know, we didn't when we did this work by Mark Lovell, but we now know that how many satellites we expect in the Milky Way in total. It's about 120. Now, so, but we could talk about that later, but, well, anyway, so that's, all right, so let me answer Simona's question. So if we knew how many satellites there are, then we could make a rigorous comparison. But clearly, if you have a model that predicts fewer than the ones we've already discovered, then that model is ruled out. And that's what happens with these values of L6. So they have fewer than, I mean, here, for example, at some mass of 10 to the 8, they already fail by factors of several. So you can then, but the trouble is it's more complicated. I'm not trying to go into all the complexities because the number of satellites depends also on the mass that you think the Milky Way halo has. So Gaia is going to tell us what that is, and then it will eliminate one freedom. But at the moment, the problem is complicated because it's degenerate. There's two parameters, the mass of the Milky Way halo and the mass of the stellar neutrino. But there are already things you can already exclude very confidently. So for example, this one, you can exclude it just by eye because it has no satellites, right? It wouldn't even make the LMC. But it's a bit more complicated. But all I'm saying, yeah.
Right, so the connection between this warm dark matter and the 7 keV is based on the assumptions of that production mechanism, right?
For the stellar neutrino.
For example, the stellar neutrinos have 7 keV mass, but the mixing angle is way too small for oscillations to produce them. But if they are produced from decays of heavier particles, some singlet Higgs or something, then this picture would correspond to 2 keV mass and not 7 keV mass. Because of that factor 3 reduction in the free streaming length that happens at the QCD transition. Right? And in addition, you know, how do we suspect that 7 keV stellar neutrino might exist? By the X-ray line, right? But that X-ray line and its effect on ionization and molecular hydrogen formation is not taken into account here when it comes to star formation, right?
Well, sure, you can do that. I mean,
no, what I'm saying is that
yes. Right? So you don't even need to understand ionization or any of the gas physics, right? So if you assume that, so say you have a well-defined stellar neutrino model and you know how many lumps of dark matter there are.
Right.
And you assume that galaxy formation is 100% efficient in those, right? And you still don't have enough to account for the observed satellite, but you can rule that model.
But your star formation starts earlier than you expected if you account for the effect of X-rays that these stars.
Sure, but you can make a point that's independent of the details of galaxy formation. For example, here, right, there are no lumps. So this one is less extreme.
But
no matter how efficiently.
I'm just questioning against interpreting this as these KV numbers, right? So these KV numbers can refer to something completely different from the mass of the actual neutrino.
Sure.
Whereas the X-ray signature refers to the mass of the actual neutrino.
Yeah, you're not trying to pull out 7 KV neutrino, right?
Yeah, no, we are.
No.
Not all. For certain values of these other parameters. So the 7 kV, hold on, let me answer your question. The 7 kV stellar neutrino that I show you in the minimum standard neutrino model has a range of power spectra. Where did they go? Oh, almost there. No, maybe not.
Hold on. Production mechanism, you can rule it out, but otherwise, if the production mechanism is different,
that's right.
The spectrum.
Well, this is the minimum, whatever they call the Boyarsky-Shaposnikov.
So
hold on. So I'm talking about these ones, right?
Correct. Right. Exactly. So for this specific production mechanism,
yes,
you are trying to rule out 7 kV neutrino.
That's right.
But because this 7 kV neutrino is never part of plasma in the early universe, it's always a couple, right? Any earlier history, any decays of particles that produce sterile neutrinos with that mass will contribute to the bank of sterile neutrinos that arrive as dark matter. With significant difference that earlier production, from whatever mechanism,
yes,
is a colder component than what.
But some of that is here, right? There's resonant production and non-resonant production.
No, no.
But it's a particular, no. The new SSM of Boyarsky and Shaposnikov,
right.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Right. So
that's well defined. There's no ambiguity there.
Right. So
if you have a different model, sure.
If you specify the production mechanism, as you do,
yeah,
by referring to a specific data.
Yes, which is what I'm doing.
Then you can use this to allow 7 kV neutrino in that production mechanism.
Right.
However, if X-rays confirm 7 kV and you rule it out, that just means that the production mechanism was different.
Sure. So I thought it was clear. I'm only talking about a specific, Shaposhnikov, Boyarsky, Ruskovsky model, which they call the minimum neutrino, minimum standard model.
So it's 2005 paper by Mishra with two collaborators that called Neumann, and this is the model you're trying to.
Exactly. I thought that was clear. Sorry if that was not clear. Okay. So I'm just talking about one specific model. As I said, the world of stellar neutrinos is more complicated than CDM. So in that particular model, there you can rule out some values of the parameters, but not all of them. So that's the point. So there's some here that are perfectly reasonable, that's CDM. But this L6 parameter that I talked about, see, L6 is 10, then that's perfectly still allowed.
Is that marginalized over all of the Baryon feedback, et cetera?
Yes,
parameters?
It is, because we're only looking at, we're assuming galaxy formation is 100% efficient. So
every subhalo has
All the baryons, the baryon fraction cools into each halo. But you see by the picture here, although this is not that model, this is just a thermal. But here, you don't have any lumps, so nothing, you don't want to make any sound.
Yeah,
Sorry, the what?
Well, those spurious subhalo.
Oh, yeah, sure, but we clean those out.
You had a follow up paper where you had a different galaxy formation model and you showed a difference. And it's not this one, it's the next one.
With Mark and
yeah, you had a paper where you had two different recipes for galaxy formation, right? You used two different
But I think now
that was to answer.
Okay. All right. So let me now. But all this is backing up the wrong tree, because that's not the way to do it. So anything that involves galaxy formation is complicated, because it has baryons, supernovae, all sorts of complexities. So the way to do it obviously dawned upon me, talking to Simona, listening to her 10 years ago, that what we're doing wrong is trying to look at the complexities of galaxy formation and using galaxies, when the clear difference is not in the galaxies, it's not in what you can see, the clear difference is what you cannot see. So what we need to do is not count galaxies. I mean, you make some progress, right? So for a specific new MSSM model, you rule some things out, fine, and you write a paper, but it's not a fundamental advance. The fundamental advance has to come not from looking at what you can see, but from looking at what you cannot see. And there that's conclusive, that's definitive. There's no argument that baryon cool or it didn't cool, or supernova or no supernova. If we could look at the dark stuff, we could then rule them out, right? So that is what dawned upon me listening to Simona talk about how you might be able to detect the lumps, just the dark lumps that never made a baryon. So the big kind of revelation I had in the last 10 years is that all the work I've done in my life before, trying to understand what we can see, is a waste of time if I'm interested in finding out what the dark matter is. I mean, of course, I'm interested in other things too, but if your goal in life is to know what is the dark matter, you can make two mistakes. One, listen to particle physicists, because they don't find anything. Two, try to listen to astronomers, because they only see the visible universe, and the visible universe is too complicated. And so we'll never get to the fundamentals by talking either to astronomers or to particle physicists. So talk to people who...
Convincing astronomers are going to answer this question in the way that you're going.
Well, it's the new form of astronomy.
Why didn't you give us
data?
No. I didn't tell you which data.
That's what you said. I know it's
sorry, is that what I said?
You said you shouldn't pay attention to astronomers.
Observational astronomers. Sorry, no, thank you. So I meant to observational
observations that will give right, the so, amount of dark matter.
Yeah. So let me tell you how you do it. Right. Let's get serious again. So This is taking too long. So I wanted to write some stuff on the board, but maybe I won't be able to. But here's the key point, right? If you look at the mass function, subhalos or halos, it doesn't matter, then here's where the difference, they're very different. Right? This is looking at dark matter, and here you see that in the case of cold dark matter, so it's the number of halos function of mass, small mass, high mass, Then you see that, as we know, we've known for 30 years, in the case of cold dark matter, there are halos of all masses. In the case of warm dark matter, as you can see here, the mass function just peters out. And it peters out at some scale that depends on the mass of the particle. So for example, this is not for the Shaposhnikov-Boyarsky stellar neutrinos, but just for a generic thermal particle, a warm dark matter particle, here at a mass of 3.3 keV, you see that there's a cutoff. Now the problem arises in that if you look at the scale here, which you probably can't, but the differences here occur on the scales that in my previous plot I showed, there's no galaxy formation. So these are completely dark. And so that is in a way a problem, but on the other hand, it's a great virtue because these halos here where the two models are different, they've never seen a baryon in their life. And so you can see them, but
at the 10 to the 8 level, you're still affected by physics processes that changes the masses of the object that you're.
Well, yes and no, but let me answer that question with a plot. So the main thing is that, so these halos here, these little ones, we cannot see them if they're too small for gas to cool into them. Well, you never see them in stars, but you can detect them. And that's what Simone and other people can do for a living. So how do you rule out CDN? Well, so you have to forget about baryons, which is difficult for an optical astronomer like me to say, but baryons are misleading. Forget about them. Just look at the dark side of the world. And the dark side you can see through lensing. So the trick is gravitational lensing, where you can then detect halos that are too small to have ever made a galaxy. They're completely dark. And what happens here then is that there's a particular phenomenon of lensing called Einstein rings, where you have a very good alignment between a source, a lens, and the observer. So if the alignment is perfect, you get one of these amazing phenomena that nature has made for us called the Einstein ring. And here are some Einstein ring pictures where you have a very good alignment between the source, the lens, and the observer. Now, so it turns out that, so everything lenses, right? Everything that has a gravitational field produces distorts light or deflects light. And then even these dark halos, which are the ones we're after, where we don't have to worry about baryons, they will produce lensing. And there's a particular kind of lensing that I think the first person you'll know, Simona, to think about it must have been Leon, no? Koopmans, no? About the lensing of these dark halos. No? Anyway, before then?
That was Schneider, 1998.
Schneider.
Mauen Schneider.
Yeah.
Oh, Mauen Schneider, okay. Anyway.
But
you were thinking about bigger ones, huh?
No, they can grow smaller. Anyway,
so it's been known for 15 years or so that
these
would produce
different kinds of images. So
right. So the particular, right. So what happens here is that this objects here, when you have a perfect alignment or a very good alignment between a source, a lens, then that will produce the Einstein ring that I just mentioned. But the Einstein ring will be distorted by small perturbations that the light suffers when it goes by the gravitational potential of a small lump. So that is what this is a plot from Simona, one of Simona's papers. And here you see this beautifully that. You see here a image of a Einstein ring, as these are called, and you see a big perturbation that an Einstein ring has suffered because the light has been affected by the gravitational field of a small lump. Except in this case, you can see it, but it's not a small lump. In this case, it's a big lump. It has a mass of 3 × 10^10, which are not the ones that are interesting for our purposes, because they're the ones that have baryons in them, and baryons make things complex. So these are a demonstration that the method for detecting lumps works, but this is a proof of concept, but it's a very large object. So now here's a paper from Simona, it must have been your thesis, Simona, where you can then see, in fact, well, not in this paper, but so Simona, I hope she agrees with me, although we discovered recently that we mean different things by mass, but now that we more or less mean the same thing by mass, that.
Then you have to multiply both by a factor of 10.
So, All right, 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 for modern masses. Anyway, the point is you can detect, it doesn't matter if 7 and 8 or 8 or 9, well, it does matter, but below 8. So the key thing is they're all dark below 10 to the 8. So you've got to model this, but you want to focus on the ones that don't have baryons because the baryons are confusing. So then you can, in principle.
With
30
meter telescope, can you go to
10
to the
7? So I'm doing now simulations with the European extremely large telescope.
Okay.
And I'm struggling right now because the problem is that you lose a lot of surface brightness because of the resolution. So I hope so, but I'm not convinced yet. I'm working on it.
Could you see an Einstein without anything visible in the middle, like just from the dark object? Or this is not just a disturbance, but an actual. No, that's your
concern. Yeah, so there are these little small subhalos themselves aren't strongly lensing. It is the boost coming from the big galaxy. It boosts the effect of the small things.
Yeah.
So the small things alone, you wouldn't.
No.
They're weakly lensing.
Yeah.
On their own.
Yeah, so unfortunately, well, I was going to do some stuff on the board, but I'm running out of time. So.
5 minutes.
Yeah, so sorry about that. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. I had some nice little formulae that illustrate what's going on. But point is that we can detect small halos, including the ones that are dark, that are not affected by baryons, which is, I think, the key to making progress here and ruling something out. And the point
is there a limitation in how small you can look?
So, yes, the angular resolution of the data is the main parameter for this kind of technique.
How small you can
look? Basically, with the data we have now, simulation says that we can go down to 10 to the 6 if you're in the main. So if you're a subhalo, you can detect 10 to the 6. Then if you allow things to be between the observer and the lens, that could actually translate to a 10 to the 5. But the problem is that we have only few data.
But this is your 10 to the 6 or my 10 to the 6?
No, this is an NFW 10 to the 6.
All right. Right, okay.
Is this with like HST level?
No, HST is, if you're lucky, is 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10.
Okay.
HST is not great.
But you're
a lot of numbers. So
your simulation is based on TMP?
No, so these are interferometric data. So these are global VMBI data sets. But the problem with that is it's very hard to have a number of sources which, once you observe them with that telescope, will have enough structure on the scale. So it's very hard to get systems.
And the 10 to the 6 is for one system or how many?
We have 6 systems with that resolution at the moment.
And okay. this is intervening. So these are pre-strip masses. The question
I'm about to show you that.
Let me
show you a plot that answers that question. So the point here is that all right. So we can detect subhalos of sufficiently small mass that they've never seen a baryon in their life, or if they have only a very few, not a star. And the point is, if warm dark matter is right, if the stellar neutrino or some other form of warm dark matter is right, then there should be no small halos. So, for example, the stellar neutrinos I was talking about, there should be none below 10 to the 7. We can argue whether it's 5 times 10 to the 7, depends on the model. But if CDM is right, you should find many. Right? So all you need to do is find one 10 to the 7, and you rule out most stellar neutrino models.
Okay.
So, but,
yeah. So why we need the halos to be dark? Why we care about baryons in the small halos?
Well, for two reasons. One is if you take the reported measurement of a 7 kV stellar neutrino detection through the X-ray line that several people talk about, then that translates. So for 7 kV stellar neutrinos, for example, the difference between CDM and warm dark matter only occurs where halos are all dark. So that's why. So that's one reason.
It only translates into that under the assumption of how we produce.
Sure. So, but the point is that you want to look at the dark ones because there you can do a clean test.
We don't even know if the dark halos exist, right?
No.
Maybe they
can
tell
you
know.
Yeah. Okay.
Hold on. Let's have one at a time. So Alejandro was talking first. So what do you say?
No. I'm thinking that it's an extrapolation of the model, right? It's the thinking that dark halos exist. We don't even know. That's the prediction of our simulation. But maybe there is still the threshold for information, or the cathodic information, not as sharp as we think. And what we need to prove is that the difference between warm dark matter and cold dark matter, but doesn't matter whether the halos are dark or not.
Well, no, I know, but the problem is where you're in the regime where the halos are bright, that's what I was trying, the point I was trying to make. Then you enter into the complexity of baryon physics, feedback, all sorts of complexities that makes it much harder. So I show you where, how in CDM you can get a perfectly acceptable satellite luminosity function, and you can also in a completely different model where in the warm dark matter model, I show you also a perfectly good match, one of the stellar neutrino models with a correct value of this six parameter, and you can tell them apart. And if you look at the images in dark matter, they look completely different. So that's the whole point of this.
I don't think that it's going to affect the density.
So no. Having
values in the
well, it just makes it, yeah, but it just makes it more complicated.
It might make the halos or the subhalos more concentrated.
But look, also, Alejandro, if you have, if you're in a situation, so I see what you say, but if you have, you're in a situation like this, say, right? Well, you want to tell the difference between these the 7 kV stellar neutrino and CDM. Right? It just happens that the difference here occurs where we know from physics there should be no baryons that have made it. So that's why you want to do the lensing, right? Because, you know, where the interesting things are completely different models of particle physics, where the where you can see them, they don't predict any difference. So the visible, you know, the satellite luminosity functions are identical that you can see. So you have to go to the things that you cannot see.
Anyway, they could have baryons.
They might have baryons.
Or luminous galaxies.
Yeah, and sure. But the point is to go to sufficiently small ones where the models predict different things. Okay, now, so I'm nearly finished, but this is not what I had planned to say, but still. So just two quick things. So somebody said, who said that that the central galaxy can destroy, who did? You did, okay. So the central galaxy can destroy subhalos, for sure. And then the, but the key thing is, and I think this was very exciting, it made the problem a lot simpler, that most of the signal doesn't come from subhalos that are inside another halo. So here's the plot from Till Zavala, where here you see from these Apostle simulations, here you see a dark matter only simulation, and here you see a hydro simulation. Maybe you cannot see by eye, but there's only about half the number of subhalos here than there. So that at first had me very worried. It's kind of late, so I won't belabor this point, but in a hydro simulation, the number of dark halos, these are dark, that are the ones we're interested in with masses of 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, that far fewer, and that's because they get destroyed by the big tidal fields near the center of the galaxy. So I was very worried about this for a long time, until I realized, in fact, that most of the signal doesn't come from subhalos. In fact, some of my plots are old and keep talking about subs. Most of the signal doesn't come from things in here that could be confused by interacting with the galaxy. Most of the signal comes from things that have never been near a big halo.
Not true.
Well, okay, here is, all right, most, but here's the calculation we did. I think you agree.
The calculation is not correct.
I thought you agreed with us.
No, because you have not rescaled.
For what we did.
Because you have not rescaled the sub-5 mass to the NFW mass, and so you miscalculated the lensing effect for this plot.
Yeah, so I'm going to show you that in a minute. all right, but look, the principle is this. The details we can argue about. Question is, what's dominant? The halos inside the lens or the ones along the line of sight?
No, my question was whether or not you guys understand why you disagree with previous papers on this.
All right, so let me just say, first of all, let me explain what we're arguing about.
They did a point source and fluctuation anomalies.
Hold on, let me explain for the others who don't know what you're talking about. So what this plot shows is from a paper by Ran Lee. This tells you the contribution to the lensing signal. Unfortunately, the axis here, for some reason, got deleted, but that's what the axis is. Right? Anyway, so essentially it's the contribution to some lensing signal from subhalos in the main halo, which is the dashed line for CDM, and from warm dark matter, some particular warm dark matter model, against the total number. And you can see here, so Simone is criticizing this, but I thought we agreed, but still, that in the case of CDM, there's a difference here. It's not an order of magnitude, but it's a factor of 5 or so. Most of the signal here comes from halos that are along the line of sight, not inside the lens. The ones inside the lens, you need to model and could be complicated.
Depends on depends on the source and lens relationship.
Of course, this is for a particular lens that we were modeling at rich 0.2. Sorry, the lens was at rich 0.2. The source doesn't really matter that much.
Well, it
does matter. Well, it was whatever redshift we had. So it's a proof of concept to tell you that you don't need to worry, depending on the setup, too much about the processes that go on in here. Of course, you can model those, but it's a very neat test. And if you choose your arrangement, your lenses, at the farther away the lenses are, this was at redshift 0.2, if you put them at higher redshift, then the more the whatever you want to call this, the line of sight that are not in the halo dominate, right? So the point is that you can have
an experiment. Let's say if you take a DP81 or the latest HSD defined by Bolton, those would be line of sight dominated.
Okay, like, so why does that disagree then with the previous stuff by Chuck Eaton?
Because you need to fold in the lens in effect.
I'm pretty sure Chuck Eaton
folded in the lens. Yeah, no, I understand. But he folded in the lens in effect for flux ratio anomalies, assuming a point source. Why we did it is we calculated the lens in effect for arcs, which is different because you're sensitive to the first derivative.
Yeah, this quantity is, well, this plot is plotting like the surface density, right?
Yeah.
Which is a quantity that affects flux ratios as well as whatever,
So why is it so
different?
Because flux ratio is sensitive to the second derivative, so the lens in effect is...
This is surface density he's plotting.
Yes, but we're sensitive to the first derivative of the potential, so the lens
but his claim is that the surface density, which is the quantity relevant for the flux ratio anomalies, is like two orders of magnitude higher, and that's...
No, two orders of magnitude higher. No, this is the one... inside the lens, and this is the one along the line of sight.
If I do this, factor. I get a different number from Carlos.
Okay.
So we should talk
about it. Oh, Simona, we...
maybe let him finish, and
yes.
Then you have left...
Simona, we agree. For...
No, because... you have two definitions of masses. One is the NFW mass, assuming a mass concentration ratio, and then the other one is the subfine mass.
Yes.
And they're different. And if you don't map, in terms of lens and effect, one into the other, the way you rescale the mass function is going to be different, and then the contribution is going to be different.
Well, let me put it like this, for those who are not specialists. The specialists here, Neil and Simona, and I, well, not as especially by a long way as they are, differ on the details, but nobody differs in the principle. So the principle is that if you have a sufficiently large number of lenses, then with this method, you can rule out all of the 7 kV sterile neutrinos, modulus what we're hearing about the possibility that may be more complicated models, but for any given model, you can make a very strong test. For example, for the warm dark matter model that we were worrying about here, which was the 7 kV Shaposhnikov et al. Type model, if you had 100 lenses, then the plot here is, on this axis is the projected halo number density within the Einstein ring, and here is the cutoff mass in the power spectrum. So you remember the one I show you, a cutoff cuts off at about 10 to the, few times 10 to the 8 solar masses. So if you had 100 lenses and the universe is made of warm dark matter, then you would detect this cutoff with very high precision and would completely rule out CDM, because CDM has no cutoff. Conversely, if the universe is made of CDM, then you rule out this cutoff to very high precision. So the point is, this test is very strong, it's unambiguous. If the dark matter is a 7 kV sterile neutrino, you can exclude CDM, which is this case here. You exclude CDM and many, many sigma. If it is, the universe is made of CDM, you exclude the 7 kV sterile neutrino or other models by this test. And I think Neil and Simona won't disagree with that. We disagree on the details, but we don't disagree on our main conclusions.
I don't disagree, I'm just asking questions.
Yeah. But the question is, I think the message for those who are not specialists is this, that this is a test that is doable and that will, in the next few years, I don't know how many, rule out CDM or rule out most other interesting alternatives with no ifs and buts. There'll be no complications due to baryons. This is just pure Einstein gravity, and that's all that's involved here. So here are my conclusions then. Sorry, I didn't get to write on the board the interesting part, but the main point is that, of course, lambda CDM is a great success, but we don't know. It doesn't tell us that success, whether the dark matter is CDM or warm dark matter. We need to look on small scales where the differences are important, and there's a way to do it. I think counting satellites that you can see is never going to be conclusive because the baryon physics, fascinating as they are too complicated, and so we'll never be certain just by counting optically lumps whether we live in the universe of CDM or warm dark matter. You have to go and look at the dark stuff, and this test and others that Neil can tell us about, they can conclusively rule out eventually one possibility or the other. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Yes. No, that would be a big mistake. So depends what science questions you're interested in, right? So I spent all my life working on the visible universe, which is quite interesting, but this is just a very specific question. If your mission in life is to determine what the dark matter is, you can become a particle physicist and do laboratory experiments, or you can do lensing.
But so the baryons are involved in the lensing. I don't understand, right? Because in the lensing, you also have baryons, so you can't just... Lensing.
Well, these little ones don't have any baryons. That's the main thing. So yeah. So he was saying, somebody, he was saying...
But the lensing results are affected by baryons, so you have to...
No, no. So this is the thing. So
they are, but less strong than that.
The stuff we're talking about, they never seen a baryon in their life. So the ones that are inside,
but
that's...
don't do lensing without baryons, I guess.
Yes, you do lensing without
baryons. Model. Okay, that's where
well, okay, you need a galaxy.
Yeah.
You need, look, you can rescue the swimmer that's drowning in the ocean with a lighthouse, right? But it doesn't mean to say that the swimmer doesn't need to produce the light herself. The swimmer can be dark. You shine a light on it. So what happens with the lensing is, of course, you need to have a lens. You need to have a galaxy, right? But the swimmers here are completely invisible.
Do you think the results are dependent on the 7 kV, but more generally on warm, whatever it is, 50 kV, because, just...
We've already killed 50 kV. Satellite.
You killed it?
Well, yeah. No, sorry.
No, not 50
right.
kV.
50 kV, yeah. Sorry,
not 50.
No, I thought it's about 3 kV.
Yeah. No, you're right. But the question is a very, very good one, that if you set this benchmark at 7 kV or 3 kV, not where we want to go. We want to go to GEV.
Yeah.
We want to go to electric GEV.
Much better, exactly.
Right? Well, no, hold on. But then this won't work.
Exactly. This won't work.
So,
right?
No.
So the big question out there is not, is it 3 kV or not?
Right.
Is it 100 GeV? And that's where we need to be thinking for decades in the future.
That's
right?
A separate problem, right?
But setting this up as this is the final solution.
Look, wait. It's the final solution for the very, very well-defined problem. So there are people who claim, who Boyarsky and Markovitch.
No, we know those people. But the thing is, 50 kV, is it interesting? You might have ways to look for a 50 kV ceramic.
Well, sure, but they are CDM. A 50 kV sterile neutrino is cold dark matter.
What you're testing is spectrum. It's just a spectrum.
Does it have a cutoff or not?
Dependence of the dark matter. Forget the label.
Yes.
It just has a spectrum.
Right.
You have a different spectrum. So, you could have particles that are very heavy, depending on how you form them. They could be warm too.
Sure.
You're not testing a mass.
I agree.
It's just a spectrum. This is a label. So you just understand the spectrum. This spectrum has a particular shape, is warm.
Right. So
the other is cold. That's it.
Sure. No, it's absolutely right.
But that does not discuss exactly your...
No, but the reason that it's timely to talk... The reason why it's timely to talk in the language I was using. I'm just being totally empirical. I'm totally empirical. There are people out there, many of them good friends of mine, who claim they have detected a dark matter particle which has a mass of a keV and it's a stellar neutrino. So they are, for all I know, they are right.
You will not be able to rule out with these methods. You will not.
No.
So in other words, if you prove that dark matter is entirely cold on these scales, and if the 3.5 keV line persists, that means that dark matter can be composed of 7 keV sterile neutrinos,
The point is this, right? There are claims that of people who've detected a certain type of dark matter, and they are there, and they may be. What this can tell you, all right. So let me refine the conclusion. The conclusion is this: with this method, you'll be able to detect, I think, along what Graciela is saying, whether the power spectrum of density perturbation has a cutoff, on some range of scales,
and the range of.
Sorry, but the concept point. Where if the cutoff is on too small a scale, then you don't detect it. So you only detect it on a range of scales, which happens to be interesting because that's where there are some people who claim to have seen something.
But I think, I mean, for our perspective, we have everything we need in the analysis and the data. I think what is really missing somehow is the correct prediction to compare with, because most of the time, you know, we just get these fixed mass functions, we don't know if they're reliable. And I think that actually on the interpretation side is one of our most unknown at the moment.
So that's one of the main things you're disagreeing on, right? Like, I mean, you were asking, well, how do you know all the halos are line of sight versus not? It's really important because it determines whether the baryons are changing the mass function or not, right?
But you know, the problem.
You're not going to distinguish between a line of sight and a sub-halo on a one-to-one basis most of the time because the resolution of the data will not allow you to do that. But what you do in a statistical sense by reinterpreting your results, allowing for both possibility to be probable according to the mass function they're coming from, the power spectrum coming from even a certain model. So you can do it in a statistical sense.
But shouldn't there just be a right answer? Like, are most of the halos line of sight or not?
Sure. Oh, it depends.
Oh, no, there is.
On a CDM model, it depends on the redshift of the source and the lens.
Yes. And if the. If the,
at,
if the
redshift, no, at higher redshift, they become more
okay,
and more.
But
known.
If the halos. Subhalos are in a bigger halo, as you showed, you will be susceptible to baryonic effects.
Sure. I mean, we understand those too. I mean, it's not that we don't know anything about those. It's not that we know something about baryon effects.
You can fold it in when you're trying to interpret your results.
I know, but it's a large.
But look, the point is this.
Yeah, that's why line of sight is a cleaner measurement.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about that. Yeah. But you cannot always distinguish between the two on a one by one basis.
I mean, so that's exactly right. So you could do the test even if they were all inside another halo, but it would be less. Neat, because you have to worry about baryon interactions, which are complicated. So the beauty of this is that if the lens is far enough, then the signal comes primarily from line of sight. And the halos that have never been inside.
So you say.
Other people like 20 years ago that found opposite results.
Yeah, and he agreed that our results might be because he doesn't think that his calculations were correct because they assume a point source and that didn't necessarily capture the complexity.
So he claims that
the calculation that he done should be redone by assuming a non-point source. And then we can
compare. And that would change this like surface density calculation.
You're talking about Chuck.
Yeah.
I talked to him and he agrees with this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is Andre as well, because you know he was also on that paper.
Who?
Krasov.
Andrew Krafts. I should know because he's on my visiting committee. But we talk about the institute, not about the science. But I'm sure he does because he's helping me talk about this. Anyway, the point is.
We have a detection that we're trying to confirm, but I can't say when it's coming up.
So you're saying that.
I'm just like puzzled by the lack of agreement on this issue because both calculations seem very easy to me. And yet people find different results.
Well, they're not that easy, but you know, the workshop we're having that you're coming to. I mean, probably, we're counting on you. We even paid for you. So, this should be, unfortunately, Chuck can come. I invited him, but he can't come.
Depends on assuming a point source. The
surface density.
I'm saying, the question is that the surface density of everything which is there or everything that could be detectable? And that's what we were plotting. We were plotting the relative number of detectable line of sight and detectable subject.
Okay, so you think Chucky is applying something
else? Well, it was looking at different, right? It was looking at different probes. So already with the data that they have, they can detect 10 to the 6, I think, with flux ratios, just because you're much more sensitive. Because they're looking at secondary.
Well, that's what Neil is also. I mean, he was one of the pioneers of the
20 flux years ago, yeah.
Ratio anomalies. But so what we're talking about, for those of you who are not specialists, is the following. The what I talked about here and showed results for is a particular way of detecting substructure or structure. Well, in our case, structure rather than substructure. So structure means something that's inside another halo. Structure means an independent halo. Right? But there's an older, I don't know which one is older, but another method based on something called flux ratio anomalies that this man here was one of the pioneers of that. Now that, so I used to have a lot of hope on that, but it seems to me it's more complicated. I know you send me emails about this, but it's more complicated. Somebody has. Oh, no, not you. Not you, but anyway. I had emails telling me that is not correct. That these flux ratio anomalies where you have a multiply lensed quasar and then you look at the brightness of images and compare them to a smooth model, and then if they don't agree with the smooth model, then it tells you that the lens is lumpy. So I thought that was a very good technique, but it's very, very complicated, and it may still work, and it's still important and interesting to follow up. But this one is an alternative technique, and what I like about this one is that you're mostly sensitive if you have the correct geometrical arrangement to halos along the line of sight that have never seen, they've never been inside another halo, they've never seen a baryon in their life, or if they've seen a baryon, they've only seen a tiny number of baryons before recombination. So they are totally dark, totally free of environmental effects. So it's a very clean test. And so that's why I'm enthusiastic about this. But it's not the only method. And it's not going to rule everything out. And it doesn't mean that the visible universe is not interesting. Of course it's interesting.
Well, not interesting for dark matter. I can still go back to work on galaxy formation.
Well, sure.
Okay,
it depends what you're interested in.
In our defense, though, the dwarf galaxies, we are still measuring the smallest dark matter halos that have been measured to date.
I have nothing against, you know, I spent all my life working on galaxy formation, but it depends what is the problem you want to solve. So the problem of galaxy formation is super interesting, of course. I spent most of my life doing that, but this is a different problem. We got fed up with the particle physicists not getting their act together. They keep failing. They don't find the stuff. They keep doing more and more expensive experiments, and they're still failing to come up with a particle. Then the astronomers at some point had to say, enough's enough, we're going to solve the problem for you. If you're not good enough to find it in a laboratory, we'll tell you what it is. So that's what this is about. It's about trying to at least eliminate a whole range of dark matter candidates with an interesting cutoff.
Of course, you can have another picture.
You have what?
You can still have another picture.
Another picture.
And the mixture.
Oh, a mixture. Sure.
For example, in direct detection, you can be sensitive to something that is a very minor component.
Sure. I mean, we already know there is a mixture.
Very minor component. Most of it could be warm.
But we already know. We know there's a mixture. Sure. We already know the light neutrino has a non-zero mass. It's dark matter. Right. So we already know there's more than one.
Most likely, it's as a mixture of different things.
Yeah, I hope we don't live in a universe like that, because it will be very hard to tell what's what. But
so in the component of substructure in lens, what radius does the Einstein ring correspond to? So how far out?
That's a projection.
It's just a projection. It's like a column.
So the Einstein radius for galaxy-galaxy lensing is on average between 5 and 10 kpc, and then you have the projected inside that cylinder, basically.
Okay. And so between 5 and 10 kpc, so what I'm
and
thinking
about...
And then
if you get faster, it's going to be larger, probably, depending on where the image is.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm thinking about is the radius at which we can think about probing substructure around the Milky Way with strings.
And that radius is probably the border is something similar, so 15 to 25 or 30 kpc. And so that you tackle the same disruption problems.
The signature actually is a very similar problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's an interesting correspondence that might be
between what and what?
The streams and
yeah. You still have a lot more volume that's not that close.
Right, but even just because there's like the line of sight argument is great. I really like But if we think about, you know, within the lens.
Yeah, but it's still projected to be a very
different. Right, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the way it is. So I'm not saying that the visible universe is not interesting. Of course it is. I'm not saying that it's going to rule out every possible candidate, but it rule out, in particular, one that some perfectly respectable physicists claim they have detected.
Well, so the question of why we call warm dark matter, right? If the only reason there's any regime there was because of the small scale anomalies, right? I mean,
no, the word warm dark matter.
It's a continuum, as was.
Sure, already in the 1980s, well before you were born, so there was a classification into hot, warm, and cold.
Okay, so what's the?
But in fact, in those days, so we're talking about 1980, we had candidates for cold, which were these ones particles that are not showing up either, the supersymmetric particles. There were candidates for hot, which was a 30 eV neutrino that the Russians had claimed to have measured. There was a famous paper by Lubimov and Novikov and others claiming to have measured a 30 eV neutrino, so it was hot. And there was cold, in the case of hot, from a supposed Soviet experiment, cold used from supersymmetry and things like that. So actually it's quite interesting. Nobody knows, we're talking to some people, who was the first person to propose CDM, because there are references in some papers that are one sentence. Anyway, but then when I think it was Bond, probably, who started thinking in terms of temperature, he then had hot and cold, and he thought, let's put something warm, something in between. But there were no candidates for warm dark matter in the early 1980s. Then some candidates began to appear. Like at one point, there was a KeV neutrino, which then disappeared. But only until recently, with a stellar neutrino, was there a respectable candidate for warm. But the categories are very general and very ill-defined. And I say, you know, the warm dark matter wasn't really taken seriously until relatively recently, because there were no candidates for it. So what was your point?
So I guess the question is, if you measure 10 to the 7 solar mass halos and you rule out warm dark matter up to 5 keV or something like that, right? Do you say you've ruled out warm dark matter, or is a 10 keV particle also warm dark matter? Is it 50?
So the mass and the warmness are two different things. Okay.
Thermally produced.
But the problem is that with thermally produced warm dark matter is, then you're talking about gravitino, right? So if you, it's an example of a thermally produced warm dark matter where the mass corresponds to free stream lengths in this very simple way. Okay, so then you're asked about gravitino with 5 keV mass or 7 keV mass, then you can just apply this directly and you know what you're doing.
Which is interesting,
exactly. Now, when it comes to stellar neutrinos, it's a bucket, there's a garbage can that's our universe, and everyone passes by and throws stuff, right? And you see a person in front of you who is carrying one particular piece of garbage that she's going to put there. Now, if you base your entire calculation on that last contribution, then you can rule out or confirm it with a given mass. But because that garbage can is sort of, collecting everything from the early universe, right? Any particle at a high scale that decays producing sterile neutrinos will also contribute to the same garbage can, right? So the contribution from these other earlier processes may actually be significant, It doesn't have to be just the last person who you source to put something in. And that contribution tends to be cold because anything you produce before QCD phase transition tends to be a crossover, tends to be redshifted in terms of their momentum. And the fact that 3 is a significant factor for this. So in other words, 7 keV sterile neutrino produced at the electrolytic scale from singlet Higgs decay will have the appearance of a 20 keV thermally produced particle, for example, gravity, right? So since Carlos is not attempting to rule out 20 keV thermally produced dark matter, he probably will not be able to rule out 7 keV sterile neutrino produced before QCD transition, right? So that's the issue, right? So if the X-ray astronomers insist that there is a 3.5 keV line and it's there, and the structure formation insists that dark matter is colder than the thermally produced, say, 15 keV particle, then that does not rule out 7 keV sterile neutrino, right? That just tells you that, the contributions from earlier processes dominate over the last contribution that happens at the temperature 100 MeV from neutrino solutions.
Yeah, but I mean, it would be, I agree. I mean, I think most of the, what would be most spectacular would be to rule out CDM. That really would be good. If you can show that there are no halos with a mass less than 10 to the 7, then that would be the most exciting thing. I mean, it would rule out all my life.
Yeah, you see the kind
of... But, that's what science is about.
We wouldn't rule out your life. We can confirm your life based on scientific evidence.
Yes.
But...
my life work, I said.
No,
not my life.
We would say that your life work...
I didn't say it rule out my life. I said it rule out my life work.
No, we would say that your life's work has led to the most significant discovery in history.
So I remember Jim Peebles was always trying to encourage me in that way.
Okay, but from the point is, point of view, if you confirm CDM, okay.
You'll never confirm CDM.
Right, exactly.
I don't think you can never confirm it.
If you ruled out, you actually told us something about microscopic particles.
Yes, exactly. So I think the most exciting result. You can never if you do a laboratory experiment and find the particle, sure.
No, but if you exactly.
But astronomically.
The spectrum.
You'll never be able to.
SITM would give you the same spectrum, right? Yes. I mean, right. Because many things with the same power spectrum doesn't have to be CDM. CDM means collisionless, perfectly cold idealization.
Exactly. It could be something else.
Yep.
So how about the spectrum? Probably to show that thing, like, rule out CDM.
How do
you get to the point? How the gravitational lensing rule out the CDM? If you see no halos, CDM predicts halos. So if you see no subhalos, you rule out CDM.
So there
is a cutoff in the spectrum.
But is that maybe just in not enough statistics in observations?
Well, this
also
is
ruling
the point.
Out is like a certain error bar.
Yeah,
right?
that's the point.
So the thing is,
one answer is like, no.
It's to be honest, it's much easier to rule out warm dark matter than CDM, because warm dark matter, you rule it out by finding something.
Right.
CDM, you have to rule it out by not finding something. And that's much harder. So what would rule out CDM would be if you do this lensing, for example, or his lensing as well. I only talked about one method or more. And you conclude that there are So what do you say? If you rule out warm dark matter, if you find small things, which is a positive thing you do. You discover something, here it is, and warm dark matter doesn't predict this, you rule that out. Ruling out CDM is much harder because you have to rule it out by absence. By not seeing something.
You have to prove that you could have observed it and you didn't.
So right. So the bar is very high.
If you don't observe, because you cannot observe, that's the end of it.
Right, but we know how to quantify our sensitivity.
Right.
So this man who kept shaking his head, and that lady who keeps saying that my plot is wrong, and I and several others, we're getting together in a few weeks. So you're coming. It's a command. So we're getting together. I hope you're coming in Iceland to try and do design a whole set of tests that when the data there and somebody says, I don't find the small halos that CDM predicts, the community will then accept that. So I hope you come.
The non-observation is always much more
difficult. Well, so I just want to say, like, as a young person in this field, I'm confused about this, like, tendency to talk in terms of ruling things out or confirming things. Like, we're, as she said, I think very well, we're probing particular aspects of dark matter physics, like with these lensing measurements, we're probing a cutoff in the power spectrum. With the Milky Way satellites, we're probing other interesting aspects of dark matter physics, like the connection between galaxies and halos at these small scales, which haven't been measured.
But what are you confused about?
I mean,
it's a strong
impact. Depends what the problem is.
About the way you were sort of talking about ruling out or confirming these paradigms. I think maybe
I don't think you can confirm anything. You can rule out, but you can never confirm.
No, this is just the spectrum.
That's a philosophical.
You're right.
We can talk about philosophy some other time, but we agree that you can rule things out.
Let them talk.
Yes, go on.
No, let's not use the words rule out.
Right, okay.
You're right. Let him talk. Yes, go on. Yeah, go on.
I just think maybe it's a more sort of productive way to think about things in terms of, like, you know, talking about, say, the physics, like we're probing a cutoff in the power spectrum with lensing measurements rather than we're ruling out some class of more dark matter.
But it's sort of the same. If you find a cutoff, you rule
out. Carlo, I fully understood. What's exactly your point that you think the language is misleading?
You're making.
Yeah, it's not the 7K. He's right. You cannot say that it is the 7K that you're ruling out. This is not.
Because you've ruled out a cutoff in the power spectrum.
The production of dark matter with particular momentum.
All the models that you expect that specific cutoff moment.
And the question is, what are those models? And I think a lot of the time we don't know the answer.
Which would be
But just the fact that you have ruled out that, I mean, that's, I mean,
that's
that
a big
is
deal.
Something
if you see any spectrum you have cut off, you have ruled out the example.
Right, but I think it's worth being careful.
And
about.
If you find the cutoff somewhere else, even better.
So let's hear what he's going to say. Because he's right, he's young, and so
you're
in the future.
I just think it's worth being careful about, you know, specifying. We've ruled out some class of models, like, we're probing some physics here. We're not just, like, ruling out warm dark matter, trying to confirm warm cold dark matter with lensing measurements, for example.
I just feel like as an observer, it's more comfortable to write statements about things that you're measuring in, like, a more
Let's have one conversation. So Graciela, is it what he said?
From an observer standpoint, I think it just makes a lot. I feel much more comfortable making statements about the things that we can actually measure and about, like, sort of a general statement. Like, I think it's extremely profound just to even say from an observational standpoint that we have detected a subhalo that basically is completely dark, that has, like, no baryons in it. I mean, that's just, like, a very profound, like, qualitative difference in their understanding. And I feel much more comfortable about saying something like that rather than phrasing our arguments in, like, a more, like,
let's get his point. No, it's not a bombastic thing. The point is, hold on.
That's the definition.
Graciela, let me just answer to this one. So if you find, so there's a whole bunch of people spending millions of your taxes, you pay taxes, right, of your taxpayers' money, looking, for example, for cold dark matter in direct detection. So if we find from the lensing that's ruled out, then that is a huge progress. It means all these community looking for certain types of dark matter are backing up the wrong tree. So it's absolutely useful. Conversely, if you rule out the stellar neutrinos, there's a $200 million experiment called SHIP proposed for LHC. If you show the spectrum has a cutoff, then you rule out all the people you hear doing direct detection experiments. Many of those. Depends where the cutoff is.
SHIP is not going to say anything about
the so, right, I know, but. Sure.
If you have a cutoff, right, that's a KEB-ish, then a lot of the direct detection experiments that are looking for a nuclear recoil are barking up the wrong tree, right?
Not necessarily, because
there's an admixture.
Regardless of whether neutrinos have masses or neutrinos.
But
even 100 GV
and then their rates are all off. So I mean, if you see a cutoff, it is a big deal, probably.
It would be a big deal, absolutely.
But you put a lot of people out of business, so that's why you need to talk. That's what this is about. Out of business.
I guess I just feel like whatever observation you make, theorists make a model.
No.
Personally, do this spectrum. This is what I was saying, it's a definition. If you define that one,
but warm-dark matter is no meaningful definition. Warm is wherever the like the boundary of your
eyes. No.
It's just that definition.
It means it has a cutoff.
So if it's cutoff, it's not there. They will give you a power spectrum, which is
exactly. So that's what I'm saying. So we emphasize by saying this is the power spectrum that we measure. End of story.
Yes.
No.
Models that are inconsistent.
Exactly.
But that's it. You have to translate it to what it means for the particle physicist experiment.
And that's where it's actually getting. Because we measure something, and then it turns into something rather the comparison
in measuring and a range. This is you also that most of these calculations, most of these things, are produced before for the temperature of the universe was 4 MeV. Many of those are that, and we do not know cosmology before 4 MeV. Assume that the cosmology before 4 MeV is not radiation dominated. You could be coming out of a period of reheating with 4 MeV, and then all the production of particles is produced during this very non-standard cosmological period. Then you can produce things in a very different manner. So what you're testing is really a spectrum of perturbations. You're not testing
sure.
particles, because it's a particle. Plus a production mechanism.
Yes. Okay.
But look, but most of the dark direct detection experiments are looking for something very concrete, which is a massive particle that would behave like cold dark matter. If you were able to show that the power spectrum has a cutoff at some scale, all those experiments become redundant. So all those experiments...
Not necessarily, because there are people who, for example, will...
You're testing the bulk.
...will find compelling arguments for supersymmetry, and one way to test supersymmetry is to find certain relics which may not dominate the density of that matter, but may still be present there. And like Graziella was pointing out, that direct detection experiments can be sensitive to some dominant component of that matter and can tell you about new physics.
But look, if astronomers...
I never felt that WIMPs was a strongly motivated case.
I never went that way. I mean, it's a government funding issue, but I always felt
that WIMPs case was overstated, and I personally didn't spend much time working on WIMPs. However, every time I was on a panel that considered funding for something WIMP related, I found it very well motivated, and I always supported that because I think that there's something about it, right? So there's a difference between what I want to work on, and because I have just one life, and something that I want the government to fund because government has many billions of dollars, right? So it's a different issue.
In direct matter detection, you cannot really prove that you have tested.
If you ever find something, you cannot prove that actually it is the dominant.
But I think what Carlos and Nina has seen those plots, right, with this huge scale and dark matter masses and all these different models. And if you find a cutoff, you basically tell people where to focus.
Absolutely.
Right? So
it would be fantastic. One way or the other is a fantastic result.
But this is very important.
Many other time scales. things. Like, for example, understanding all the baryonic physics that will give you or not particular characteristics in dwarf galaxies, which is forever. I don't know, forever and ever. Instead, 5 years is free.
No, isn't that the time scale now? I was going to ask, what's the time scale? For the whole definitive...
I mean, if it is
we want it in writing.
Let's
I tell you what, the practitioners, I hope he's going to come. Now he's telling me he's not coming. He's down on the list. So we have a meeting, a secret meeting, not secret, it's in a location that's very special, in Reykjavik, in Iceland. Not secret, but the practitioners, people are actually working on trying to detect these things. So we're all getting together. Hopefully this man is going to come. She's definitely coming. And we're going to try to set out the path for these tests based on this particular form of lensing, and there are others, as he keeps telling us, but on this particular test, how are we going to convince the community one way or the other if we find or don't find these lumps? So, and that the technology is there. I mean, the data probably already exists. It's just the modeling.
The data depends on.
The modeling is complicated.
Depends on how much data you want, right?
So it's.
You want
the
ELT data already?
No, the ELT is not being.
No, it's
that is
not.
That's the
star line.
So the
ELT
is
going to
be around 2022 and above, first slide.
No, but I think there's already data.
What is the data you're using, the interferometric?
So there's a reason that we have 6 lenses and we are modeling them as being the pain because the data is gigantic.
From what data?
Is global BFVI, so you take whatever antennas in Europe, connect with some antennas in US, and then you get very, but we don't have many because again, you need sources which have a structure. In this case, when you look them over an interferometer, they don't resolve out. And a lot of the sources don't have that. So at the moment we have, I think 6 of this quality. But there's a lot you can do with less quality, but then you really have to have large numbers. So
which transition are you observing?
So this was 5 gigahertz, continue.
Can you get more than 6? Can you increase?
So that's what we're working on now. So our group is working into trying to get more. And hopefully with the new, you know, objects that will be discovered, then you can try to follow them up.
But would 6 be enough to say anything?
If the sensitivity is really as low as the simulations say, there will be enough to say, and we live in a cold dark matter universe, there will be enough to constrain the parameters of the CDM mass function well enough. The problem is that because you have very high angular resolution, suddenly the area which is sensitive gets shrinked, right? And so then you have to fold in the probability that something will actually be in a position where you can detect. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember, I haven't really run the numbers. And also because, you know, the sensitivity changes across your data, so you really need to calculate it for each lens and for each position, so that takes time.
Can you do follow up with optical and find out what's there?
But these things are dark.
No, if you have a lens that you detect with VLBI,
but the optical has less resolution, right? The BLBI, well, the angular resolution.
Right, so let's say you have TNT and you have that kind of resolution. Does it help?
Right, so the ELT was, and that's what I'm saying, I'm doing the simulation to understand what's the sensitivity of the ELT. And the idea would be you take the thousands of lenses that you find, and then possibly you reobserve them.
Okay.
But that's time scale 10 years because the ELT and nuclear, you know, are.
You need the ELT to be diffraction limited.
Yes, which the AAO is going to be possible, hopefully.
It has to work. Somebody has to make it work.
Yeah, well.
But look, going back to what you were saying, I mean, this is in principle immensely powerful, except that if you actually find a lump that's small, you rule out a whole class of models. So that'll be the easy part.
I never was arguing.
No, but let me finish. But the problem is the inverse, where you don't find something, right, which would rule out the standard model, which is CDM.
Great.
Now that'll be much harder.
One lump?
No, it's not enough.
That's not
well,
enough.
If you find one lump, sure.
If you find one lump, I'll say, okay, there is a supermassive black hole in the middle, and everything else gets stripped off, and this is what you found.
Yeah.
Two lumps. So
that's not where we start negotiating, but
so you I mean, in principle, all it takes is just to find one object?
Direct detection experiments take three, right? You're going
to
need...
Oh, three, all right. I'll give you three. In principle, only one, but okay, I'll give you three. All right, so you find three...
You're always going to be dominated by the non-detections, and that's where understanding the sensitivity function.
But that's where it gets tricky. So ruling out CDM, rightly, because it's the standard model, is much harder than ruling out these other warm models, because the warm models you rule out by construction, by detecting something that the models don't predict. The other one, your CDM, you have to rule out by absence of detection, which is much harder.
If you sort of shut off in the power spectrum.
Because also
right?
Understanding your detection is not obvious, because
right.
You know
you
how,
rule
you
out
get
CDM.
How you got that.
Well,
it's the same calculation.
No, you only.
By your sensitivity, either way.
Well, but the detection
sure.
is more complicated because
no, but,
you could get an object of that mass.
Right.
The
supermassive
universe,
black hole. Or
so
some
the non detection.
But even with the detection, you still have to quantify
sure.
what you
yeah.
could have seen. Right?
Yeah, yeah, but there's an extra
no,
level of.
I don't think so.
That you could get
no.
Let's say 10 to the 10 in many other ways.
No, I don't think that's true. I think you don't need to know your sensitivity that well. If you give me a bona fide one single lump.
How do you know what you saw until you like quantified your measurement?
Well, hold on. If I see a lump and I can
like
measure its mass.
Like a trillion solar masses
yeah.
until I
suppose they find.
Well, hold on. Let me just answer this point. So if you see a lump and you can measure its mass, And the lump.
But that step, measuring its mass, that step already means quantifying what you are measuring.
Yeah.
Well, sure, but if you just did one lump of a particular small
okay,
mass, and you rule out a whole class.
No, okay, so you see.
Maybe
you
know the mass, sure.
You see a lump 10 to the 6 solar masses. What is it?
And you know it's 10
yeah,
to the 6.
It could be a global cluster.
Exactly, it could be a global cluster.
No,
you, see a mass 10 to the 7 solar masses. It could be a supermassive black hole that got kicked out in the merger of
yeah. It cannot be a global cluster gives you a different signal.
That's
so it's not a global cluster.
Okay,
so
supermassive black hole.
A supermassive black hole would give you a completely different signal. So you know
why you can distinguish how concentrated the object is?
Well, also, a point mass actually is quite distinctive from
yes.
this fluffy. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
A black hole
and a globular cluster.
A
globular cluster.
A binary of two
supermassive.
The black hole has the advantage. You have a black binary, right?
The black hole binary, you can tell apart from
yeah,
an
you
anecdotal.
See, but she says that
but he wish because she
wears
numbers
in
the
black
hole binary.
Right, so she can distinguish it. But I mean, a point source
yeah.
that she can distinguish point and extended
source. If you have enough sensitivity, then you can.
But let me finish the argument I was making to him. So the point is, what is much harder is to rule out CDM. As we understand it, because you have to rule it out not by detecting something, but by not detecting something. That's much harder, right? So that's what this meeting is about. So I hope you're going
to
come, because it's a much harder problem. You have to convince the world that you look for something and you didn't find it, and that's much harder than to convince the world you look for something and you found it, and this theory didn't predict it. So that's why I think it'll be much easier to rule out stellar neutrinos and warm dark matter. That CDM is going to be hard, but CDM is the price. Right, that is the standard model.
Saying we rule out the stellar neutrinos. We have a lot of problems, semantic problems.
Okay,
this is
rule
the
out.
Warm dark matter.
Rule out.
This refers to this cutoff.
Okay.
Stellar neutrinos may be produced in many different ways.
Sure, and they have a different mass.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
So
you have to be a bit more precise.
Staying with warm dark matter is much safer, because otherwise you will have always people like him.
But the trouble is, what most people understand by warm dark matter is a thermally produced particle with a particular power spectrum. But if the warm dark matter is something more interesting, then the power, or more interesting, more complicated, then the power spectrum is different from the stellar neutrino, for example. But the main thing, the main reason I pick on the stellar neutrino is because there's a claim out there by two independent groups to have discovered a sterile neutrino with a mass of 7 kV.
But you don't know
what's
the
claim?
How warm that dark matter is, because you don't know how it was produced in the early universe.
Well,
and there are several avenues for producing
sure. But we agree that there are claims by two independent groups. They found something.
So
the question is, what's the power spectrum?
So, okay, so
it could be colder.
If I just characterize it by these two claims.
And
it can have a range for the same mass, and it can have a range spanned by three orders of magnitude. Okay? So, you know, in that interesting KEV-ish region, so not three orders of magnitude, factor three. So in that interesting range of KEV,
it's what?
That factor three takes you from something that they can identify as to something that they cannot identify as one.
But you know, but the thing is, Boyarsky and Bubu claim to have found a sterile
trigger.
No, they claim to have seen a 7 keV. They have a line in the X-ray spectrum.
So
you know the wavelength, 7.1 keV. And then that's the measure. And then you can interpret it in more than one way.
That's not to respond to a spectrum. So a power spectrum or to a spectrum momentum. The spectrum momentum tells you it counts.
So how you trace that's the first mass.
That's right.
Sure.
Assume that you produce a spectrum very early on. And this is a spectrum that
this
is approximately what he is proposing.
Yes, no, I agree.
Early on, most of it
is
sure. To be silenced, but what you are
I just mean like this paper from like 20 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, I don't remember, so I took
so this
okay, but the methodology is like this, right? So some people claim to have seen a 3.5 keV line. They interpret that as a 7 keV particle. Well, they interpret this 7 keV particle.
Exactly, but
that
doesn't tell you what they
do. It doesn't tell you how warm it is.
And there are different models.
The what?
There are different models for production.
Okay, good.
Right.
And some models say it's cold, and some models say it's warm. Right. So then you're ruling out one particular model, and that's fine. That's fine. But you're not ruling out the particle that gave the 3.5 keV line. You're ruling out the model for producing that particle in the real universe.
But I don't think you have infinite freedom. I mean, I'm sure if you have an exotic
model, you have a freedom with the factor 1 to 3.
In any case, in this mechanism,